Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we focus on in this show. We talk about strategies, and I share blueprints and ideas. I share some of those big, epic mistakes I've made along the way. I interview different experts in the field, all because I know that teachers are vital in helping students have voice and choice in their learning and develop that creative potential. And before we get started, I just want to share a word from our sponsor. Just kidding, it's going to be multiple words, because if it was one word, it wouldn't be an advertisement. So, multiple words from our sponsor. Here we go. Teachers, do you need to identify instructional gaps, provide personalized learning paths, and track learning progress to mastery for students? Then listen up. McGraw-Hill has an adaptive learning program called ALEX, and it has already helped millions of students. ALEX is an online math and science program for grades 3 through 12 that will inspire confidence and yield measurable results. With dynamic learning paths and real-time feedback, ALEX can be used for intervention, acceleration, and enrichment. Get 2 months free at mheonline.com/math1. That's MHE for McGraw-Hill Education. Online.com/math1. ALEX has already helped millions of kids. Check it out today and see if it's the tool you need to help your students. Don't miss out on the opportunity for 2 free months only at mheonline.com/math1. That's MHE for McGraw-Hill Education. Online.com/math1. I am so excited about today's guest. I have with me here Stephanie Higgs. She is a passionate, energetic, and engaging educator whose colleagues describe as radiating contagious joy. And you know what? I totally can see that. The times that we've met up, which has been twice, that has been so true. Stephanie earned her undergraduate and graduate degrees in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where she then taught for 6 years at a museum magnet school, which we'll be getting into here in a bit on this interview, and helped students achieve up to 3 years growth in reading in a single year. After relocating to Nashville, Stephanie became a fourth grade teacher, which has been a dream of hers since she was, well, in fourth grade herself. In 2019, Stephanie became a gifted educator and differentiation coach, where the staff quickly named her their Teacher of the Year. Stephanie knows that learning is not bound by the front and back of a textbook or the walls of the classroom, so she offers engaging, enriching units filled with hands-on opportunities and community outreach to her students daily. Her primary focus is maximum impact on student achievement, and she is all about this idea of empowering students with voice and choice, and especially with creative work, which is what we're going to dive into today. I am really excited about this because it's a chance to have an interview with a current classroom teacher, a current practitioner who's doing some amazing creative work with her students. And I was just super excited about this interview. So without further ado, here is Stephanie Higgs. All right, Stephanie, so I want to start off with your journey as a teacher. So kind of if you would begin with where you started out as a teacher, kind of why you became a teacher, and then we'll move on from there a little bit.
Okay, so I have wanted to be a teacher since I was in the fourth grade, and more specifically, I dreamed of being a fourth grade teacher. So I was that kiddo in elementary school that watched my teachers like a hawk. I wanted to be just like them. I would buy the outfits and the purses. I mean, just everything. Like, honestly, a little bit scary. But I've just always been obsessed with education. And, I've recently been going through the Teacher of the Year process in the state of Tennessee, and I was asking my mom if she had any pictures pictures of me playing school when I was little because I played it way after other kiddos had moved on to, you know, cooler pastimes. And she said, you know, you were just doing it as often as you were talking. Like, I don't even think I thought to take pictures because everything you were doing when you were a kid was playing school. So I think that's just always just been such a passion of mine. And so specifically, like I said, had that dream of teaching fourth grade. And so once I became a teacher, I started in pre-K. I was a pre-K assistant. And then I had an opportunity to teach second grade for 5 years at a museum magnet school in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And that was a really special opportunity because we partnered with all of the local museums in town. And so we took weekly learning expeditions. So we took our students out of the classroom to a specific museum that we partnered with. We had art museums, the zoo, just all the aquarium, anything you could think of was all within about a 10-minute drive from our school. And so we had weekly learning expeditions to area museums. But then also at the end of our quarter, each time we would create a museum within our school building. And so all of our science and social studies were taught through thematic units. And so that was a really special way to begin my teaching career. But then after about 5 years there, I relocated to Nashville, Tennessee. And at that point, finally got this dream come true. I got to teach fourth grade. And so that was so special to have these kids and say, I have wanted to be standing in front of you since I was in the fourth grade. This is a literal dream come true. And so I had that position for 3 years. And then at that point, I was really ready to start working in a different capacity. I sort of explained that I had all of these passions just kind of inside me building up, and I just wasn't quite sure what direction those were going to go. And then that really resulted in the perfect position for me. It just fell in my lap. But I'm currently a gifted educator and a differentiation coach. So I teach the intellectually gifted students at my school, and then I'm also a differentiation coach. So I partner with all of the teachers in the building to help them adjust instruction accordingly to meet the various needs of their students.
So what drew you to the museum magnet school? I'm curious about that.
So I actually had an opportunity when I went to undergraduate school and graduate school in Chattanooga. And during that undergrad experience, I had a practicum placement at the Museum Magnet School. And so I spent, actually, this was such a great time because I was only a sophomore in college, but I spent a semester at this Museum Magnet School, and all day, every day, I was at this Museum Magnet School. And so part of the day I would be in a classroom, and then the other part of the day, our professors actually came to the Museum Magnet School and taught us there. So there were 9 or 10 girls in my cohort at that time. And so it was just such a great experience. We had 2 full days where we were just with our class with our little kids that we were assigned to a specific classroom. But then the other 3 days a week, we would spend half the day in the assigned classroom where we were placed, and the other half working with college professors from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. So that was such a great partnership. They did that with 3 different schools, and they each had specialties, but our special area, this school I was assigned, was a museum magnet school. And once you've been in one, you can't get enough. And it sparks so much creativity. There's so much innovation. You've never seen anything like it. And I couldn't get enough. So that's when I actually went back there as a pre-K assistant, just because I wanted some more time there. I wanted to continue learning from those types of teachers. And that's such a special place to really build that teaching tool belt, because once you've, you know, sort of grown up and sort of evolved as an educator in a school like that, you can bring some of those practices, you know, really anywhere, even though you won't necessarily spend every week, you know, following that specific model. There's still so many wonderful things happening there that you can take to other schools.
And I think a lot of people hear Museum Magnet School and they're imagining, okay, so, you know, it's school inside a museum or around a museum, or, you know, oh, it's just school, but kids are going on a bunch of field trips. But it's not that at all, right? Like it is much more integrated, much deeper. So I'd love to hear you kind of, if you would, how what you did was different than, say, just going on a lot of field trips.
I love that question. So we were pretty passionate that what we did was different than just going on a field trip. So the idea of expeditionary learning as opposed to field trips is that we went with a very specific purpose. So I worked on a very closely knit second grade team. And at the beginning of each quarter, we would have an entire day of protected planning time. And we would even go visit some of these museums ourselves. We would have museum partners come to our school several times a year, because those museums are constantly constantly updating what they have to offer. So we wanted to make sure that our curriculum was relevant, that it was current, and that it was up to date for our students. And so that was all happening ahead of time, sort of behind the scenes. And then those learning expeditions were really targeted experiences. So a field trip might be, you know, several hours long. Students might be in small groups, just sort of roaming at their own, you know, kind of leisure. And expeditionary learning is very different. So you would go to a museum with a very specific, very targeted approach, and perhaps you would only be there for 30 minutes. So we oftentimes would joke, you know, we're leaving the school at 9 and we'll be back having snack by 10. And so that was how powerful it was, that just in the blink of an hour, you know, that we could have done all of this. And so those would be really carefully pre-planned expeditions. And so, you know, we might go to the Hunter Museum of Art in downtown Chattanooga to view a specific piece that was tied to our science and social studies content. Or the third quarter in second grade, we studied oceans. And so we were at the aquarium almost every Tuesday for 9 straight weeks, but we were doing something very specific and targeted each of those 9 weeks. So we might only go sit and look at the, you know, the crustacean exhibit and talk specifically about the criteria of crustaceans and what that life cycle was like. And then the next week we might be looking at cnidaria, which are the classification of jellyfish and spineless creatures. And so it was just very targeted, very specific. And then we always had culminating activities back at school. So oftentimes the expeditionary learning would inspire a piece of artwork back at school that would be a way that students would sort of demonstrate their mastery and their understanding of those science and social studies topics, which would then be represented in our school-wide museum.
So I think a lot of people, I mean, one of the, I guess, kind of cultural conceptions that people have about creativity is that creativity is open-ended and unstructured. And I think one of the things that strikes me about that story, as well as the work that you've done in your current position, is it's definitely structured, it's definitely intentional, it's definitely targeted. It's not purely open-ended and loose and anything goes. So I'd love to hear kind of what creativity looks like in your classroom now.
Okay, so something that I do as a gifted educator, part of the process in Tennessee when we are determining if a student is eligible for intellectually gifted services, in the state of Tennessee, we're one of 7 states where that falls under the term special education services. And so there are a few different assessments that are used to measure whether a student needs those special education services. The one that I administer as part of that eligibility process is the Torrance, which is a measure of creative thinking. There are 2 different ones. For younger students, we use an action and movement assessment, whereas once students are a little bit older, we use an assessment that's based more on drawing. However, sometimes students or parents might be leery when they hear that and they think, oh goodness, well, my child is really creative, but they aren't necessarily a strong, you know, artist. And so something that I love to reassure them, especially with that assessment, is that it's really not so much about the quality of the work that's produced is the ideas that are generating. And so something that we do during those assessments is we focus on things like their fluency, a student's flexibility, their originality, and elaboration. And so something that I really try to do with the students that I serve is to hit on each of those measures, because those are things that can be explicitly taught and then continued to develop and grow over time. And so fluency just means how quickly you're able to generate ideas. And so, you know, if I said, make me a list of cold foods that you can eat, then as quickly as you can, you're just going to start trying to generate a list. So that's really working on developing a child's fluency. Flexibility is the toughest one for me. Flexibility is where you sort of push your brain to think beyond the typical use for an item. So if I said, give me other uses for a coat hanger. And so, you know, I think my brain is so trained, I know exactly what it's for, and that's what I would use it for. But really saying, okay, well, what if we sort of, you know, kind of took that and unwound it and stretched it out? How else could we use a coat hanger? So that's flexibility, and gifted and students specifically love that one.
Oh, I know. It reminds me a little bit of divergent thinking tests and divergent thinking challenges, right? Where you, a similar concept where you will say, generate as many uses of 2 completely unrelated ideas as possible, right? And
absolutely.
And it's all about that flexible thinking. It's all about sort of thinking outside the box by thinking within the box. It's using that creative constraint to kind of generate new ideas. And I just love it. I love the concept of like the power of limitations.
Love that. And then the other one is originality. So just trying to think of something that no one else would think of. And then last but not least, my favorite is elaboration. So that's adding as many details to your first idea as possible. One way that I teach that is through providing students with a stimulus. So it might simply be an X in the middle of their paper. And then they have to create an entire image around that small X in the middle of their paper. And so what I love about those specific tenets of creativity is that they really each build on each other. So if you're asking a student to work on developing their elaboration, well, they can really be working on all of those, because when they see that letter X, you know, a more, you know, maybe just a more typical response might be, oh, an X on a treasure map. You know, that's the first thing I thought of. And so they create a treasure map. Well, someone else may make that tiny little X into a much bigger picture where you almost struggle to identify that original stimuli. So that's super original. Or, you know, working on their fluency, how quickly are they able to generate these ideas and add additional details? So that's something I really strive to bring into the classroom in as quick as just 1 or 2 minutes. When I go into general education classrooms, I have been covering lunches this year. You know, we're in a COVID year, so making sure that students are spaced out and so they're not all in the cafeteria. And so sometimes while students are cleaning up, just in that 1 or 2 minutes, I will put a stimulus on the board and say, you know, as soon as you're finished, go ahead and create a picture for me. Today, we're working on developing our elaboration. So these are great because they're so easy to implement and students love these quick, you know, easy ways to engage and to really develop that creativity.
I love it. Are there any other strategies that you would recommend for teachers who are saying, all right, I don't have a ton of time, but I want to be able to, I do know that creativity is important. It's important to me. You know, are there other small examples that are quick like that, that you could do, you know, in transition times or as brain breaks or things like that?
My other favorite one is called Scamper, S-C-A-M-P-E-R. And mm-hmm. Scamper is a model of creative thinking where students are asked to do a variety of activities with one object to improve upon that original object. So the S stands for substitute, the C stands for combine, the A stands for adapt, the M is for modify, the P mm-hmm. is put to another use, the E is eliminate, and the R is rearrange. When I was in graduate school, the way we learned the Scamper model was through an Oreo, because, you know, there's so many things that have already been done to create all different types of Oreos, but that's a great example for kiddos who are just starting out, and that would be such a perfect brain break. You know, if you give mm-hmm. them a piece of paper with Scamper down the side, and they sit there and think about how could they substitute part of an Oreo? Could they combine anything to make a new type of Oreo? And then I used that when I was doing a unit with my students where each grade level is assigned a universal theme. And so gifted students specifically learn better a lot of times from whole to part, whereas a lot of times general education students learn best from part to whole. So for that reason, each grade level that I teach is assigned a universal theme in gifted education. And so in fifth grade, that universal theme was conflict. And so around the end of last year, I did a big unit involving conflict. And we were also looking at change as another universal theme, which was a fourth mm-hmm. grade universal theme. And so students write all these generalizations related to change, and they sort lots of topics related to change and generate as many examples of change as they can think of. And then that unit culminated in students actually designing a new toy. And so that was really fun because we looked at classic toys and what it takes to be a classic toy and really stand the test of time. And then, you know, you give students that opportunity and that freedom to create a new toy based on a more classic design. And they came up with some really powerful options. One of my favorites was a student came up with an Etch-a-Sketch, but it was more digital. And so it was a little bit more computerized, but it was still that same idea of this small, you know, working tablet that where you could create art, but she had pieces that, you know, could kind of come out from the sides and give you extra tools, you know, like little paint cups and different things. So that's always a really fun one that really has students constantly thinking, and it just gives them a really specific model to help them adapt and create new takes on classic products or classic designs.
So when you think about this, you know, your context is gifted education. Mm-hmm. And so much of that, you know, I think about my own childhood, like I would have loved every single one of those things. But I was also, you know, I also qualified as gifted. I didn't fit the stereotype of a lot of gifted kids where like I absolutely, absolutely loathed math, and I wasn't very competitive, and I felt like there were a lot of like logic puzzles and like little competitive games, especially around patterns. And like, I hated the game Set, which was really popular with like gifted clusters and stuff. Mm-hmm. But when it came to anything creative, anything problem solving wise, anything where you could think quickly, but also think divergently, slowly, I loved it. And so much of what you're describing would have been me to a T. But then I also recognize, like, as I think about this, that non-gifted students can benefit from these strategies too, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so I'm curious, you know, what do you say to the, and by the way, I want to be clear. I'm not anti-Set. I'm not anti-logic puzzles. I'm not anti, I've grown to love a lot of that stuff now. But what do you, I bring that up for the follow-up question I'm going to ask here in a second, but what do you say to the teacher who says, that's great, you have taught gifted students, but I'm teaching students with low executive function and who are not intellectually gifted and who are struggling with school, this is going to be too much for them, right? What do you say to that teacher?
I think in that situation, there are a few ways it could be handled rather than, you know, previously you and I talked about perhaps that could be used as a brain breaker, you know, when students are transitioning. But if that was something a teacher was interested in developing, that could be done in different settings. So instead of, you know, if you have students that might be a bit of a struggle to do independently, that's something that could be really heavily modeled. And so a huge thing that I focus on with my gifted students is the idea that ideas generate more ideas, and also that our first idea is rarely, if ever, our best idea. And so there's so much power in those being, you know, communal conversations, group conversations, and those really develop and deepen community in a classroom. And so that's something that could really be modeled, not even just by the teacher, but by other students in the classroom. And so if that's something that's done a little bit more of a whole group setting, or perhaps in smaller groups, depending on the makeup of a given classroom, that's something where I still learn from my students every single day. Some of these creative activities are not specific to one grade level. So perhaps, you know, I use a flexibility challenge in a third grade classroom, and then I go use it in a fifth grade classroom. Well, when I hear the third grade idea, that sparks a new idea of mine. And then I take that idea to fifth grade, and then they really build on that. And so that's what I think is so powerful about hearing ideas of others and seeing that for students that maybe this comes a little bit more naturally, even as an adult, as a teacher, I still learn and grow from my students all the time because sometimes they are more creatively minded than I am. And so I think there's that idea that iron really sharpens iron. And so I think that we can all benefit from some of those conversations and seeing that modeled well. And I don't just mean being modeled by the teacher. Really, sometimes the student creative thinking process is so powerful for others.
My other question would be, you know, when it comes to a lot of these strategies, it can feel like, you know, something else to add to your plate, something that feels time consuming, something. And so, you know, for a teacher who's saying, I have this curriculum map, I have these standards, I have this test I'm worried about, I know creativity is important, I can see where flexible thinking might be important. I could see where doing something related to lateral thinking would work, but I don't even know how to do that when I'm, you know, I have to teach this content. What advice would you give for that teacher?
Well, I would say specifically that is something I wish I could go back in time. Of course, every year we're constantly learning, we're constantly growing. But now that I've learned so much of this through my graduate coursework, specifically in gifted education, I wish that I could take some of that knowledge back to, you know, 10 years ago, Stephanie, and share that in the classroom that she was teaching then. So I think that there are definitely places where these types of thinking could go. It just involves some pre-planning. But specifically in the areas of science and social studies, I think there are lots of great tie-ins to use some of these specific models of creative thinking. And so I think that that's a great place, you know, and it could be as fluency is just developing thoughts as quickly as possible. So it could be generate a list of as many, you know, blank, and it could be something in science or social studies specifically. And so I think that there are definitely ways to make that tie-in. But then something else, you know, that I mentioned earlier is I love that these can be 2 minutes as students are cleaning up or lining up. But something specifically in my lens as a gifted educator is the idea of buying back time. And so some of our students who perhaps already know the content, if there was some pre-planning and some forethought here, that could really extend and engage those students further who already know some of that basic content. And so something else that I really work with teachers on is the idea of product choice. And so this might be an area where you could really differentiate some of the culminating tasks that you're asking of students. So you could have a more creative option. You could have, you know, a more literacy-based option. So just kind of some different thoughts there in terms of when you're, you know, kind of finishing up a unit, some different ways that you could demonstrate mastery of the topic that might allow students these opportunities to delve a little bit more deeply creatively.
I love it. I love it. And even as I hear you, you know, talk about something like Scamper, for example, you know, there are some of these frameworks and processes can become really, really great ways to integrate the creative process into specific content area too, right? Like, you know, what would it have looked like for me as a kid who struggled with math purely because of computational fluency? Just, I wasn't great at memorizing math facts and keeping them in my head. But what would it have looked like to use something like the Scamper model to look at problem solving and say, you know, going through that process and looking at alternative ways to solve problems? Like, I even think like reversing it. I mean, that happens in math all the time, you know, those pieces. Or in planning for writing, planning for debates. I mean, there's so many areas where it feels like, you know, you as a teacher can do this as, you know, a warm up. You can do it as, I love it, like you said, during cleaning up, things like that. But it feels like as students begin to practice it, you start realizing, oh my gosh, that could be used in language arts, or that you could actually do that in science. Or so I'm curious if you've ever had moments where you've used any of these protocols and processes and then suddenly realized, oh my gosh, that fits perfectly with the content that I'm also teaching, so that it's not just a side thing.
Yeah, I think that can happen more frequently than you realize. Like you said, I think just developing the art of fluency, especially, you know, my history and my background is specifically with elementary age children. And so I think fluency is something that many of them are still developing. And that's not a negative. These are students who are really thoughtful and really thorough, and they don't move as quickly. They don't act as quickly. They don't think as quickly because they're thinking so deeply. And so it's really kind of an art that needs to be trained. But that's something that is cross-curricular that can be used and can be beneficial in any area. Like you said, there is a focus and, you know, some thought on the importance of being able to mentally recall lots of fast facts fluently. And so I think there's definitely tie overs to each of those areas of curriculum. So, you know, the example that I used was based off of a book. And so when I was talking about the Scamper model, we read Tom Paxton's The Most Marvelous Toy, and that's actually a song, but then a picture book was created. And in that picture book, you can never see the full toy. You can only, you know, it's kind of curving off a page here, kind of at the bottom of another page. And so it really leaves a lot to the imagination, but it talks about how it whirs and it spins and just has a lot of vivid, rich imagery. And so using a Scamper model was a perfect blend with, you know, with the literacy unit there. So I think there are easy ways to tie that in once you're aware of some of these specific models to each of the content areas. And so that's when I say, you know, I really wish that I could go back, because if I'd known some of these creative thinking models as a general educator, I know that there are some fabulous ways to tie those together. And so I think, you know, that would have just been another way to really extend and enrich some of that core content subject area.
So I want to move away from the classroom in particular and move kind of out a little bit into the larger context of schools. And I'm curious, what do you think, at the elementary level, you often have teachers planning together. What do you think are some ways that teachers can incorporate this into the planning that they do as a whole grade level?
I think that's an interesting thought. That's where the most recent example of me using Scamper came from, was collaboration with another gifted educator. We have one per building. So this was me collaborating with someone who does the same job, but in a different building. But we really kind of planned through what that could potentially look like with students who had similar goals in terms of what we were working on educationally. So I think that's something that could definitely, again, because I think sometimes we work better, especially when we're trying to be creative. It's a process. For some, that means closing a door and having that time just by themselves. And that's really their creative process. But for me, I think I'm so extroverted, first of all, but also I genuinely just am a sponge and I soak up learning from others. And so for me, I think my creative process is better when I have those opportunities to hear and listen and share from others. So I think one way that could be done is to have teachers go through this collaboratively together first, because it's something that you definitely need to practice before you're teaching this to your students. And so, like I said, it was modeled for me using an Oreo. And so I had to sit there and kind of think through, well, gosh, there are already so many different types of Oreos. Is there something left that hasn't been invented? And that's always usually the model that I also use with students the first time. So because that is one that we can do kind of whole group and holistically. And then from there, we sort of move more into content areas. But that's just a topic that many students are familiar with and have some background knowledge. And so that's kind of where we start. So I would definitely recommend if teachers are planning collaboratively that they go through the experience once themselves, that they start with one that's a little bit more of kind of a universal concept that many people would have familiarity with and be able to understand, and then move into some more that are content specific. And really, I would also recommend in terms of collaborative planning that would be something that would occur a little bit later as like I mentioned, one of the maybe creative choices or creative products as sort of a culmination of the learning that's occurred there. Because I really do think that that's another way to demonstrate mastery is once students have had all this exposure to the content, that then they're able to, you know, possibly create a product of their own where they're implementing things like substituting or modifying or eliminating. You know, that's really, you know, how they would think about the necessity. So if they're evaluating perhaps a tool in science and they're using the Scamper method. And so, you know, are there any parts that were in essential that we could actually eliminate with the letter E in Scamper? So I definitely think that it would be beneficial for teams to plan this collaboratively together, as I did when I first used Scamper. Just because, again, I think that's just another way that some of us think creatively and process creatively is to do this with others collaboratively. And I think that's when you would also, you know, kind of a meeting of the minds, you would come up with more creative ultimate products for your students when you kind of brainstorm through that with other educators.
When it comes to creativity in the classroom, do you tend to view it more as a mindset that students need to have or more of a skill that they need to develop? Or do you really tend to focus more on the process that they're going to be doing? So do you think of it, I mean, just your, I realize it could be a mixture, but of those three, kind of skill, process, mindset, which do you think is sort of the one you lean into the most?
Well, I'll say the opposite. I think the one I would lean into the least would be the skill, because I think that's what can be grown and explicitly taught and practiced and developed. Whereas the mindset, I think, you know, that's something I really try to break with students when they walk in and say, oh, I'm not really artistic. Oh, I'm not super creative. And that's where I want to make sure that one, that they understand that those are not one and the same, that being mm-hmm. creative does not necessarily associate directly and explicitly with being artistic. And two, that really, you know, we talk so much in education about growth versus fixed mindsets, and that it really is something that can be taught. And I think really learning more about our individual creative process, because I wouldn't say if you put me in a room and shut the door that I'm going to create very many creative products. However, if I can listen in on other students, and I'm really that type of creative producer that I need to hear what others are thinking, and I can build on that, and then someone builds on mine, and all of a sudden we've created this amazing idea for a lesson or, you know, something. Typically it's in education. That's where a lot of my creativity is poured. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, that's really something that if we have that kind of that open, that fixed mindset, that we have to learn more about our own individual process to know where that can best be stimulated and where that can best be grown. But that once we kind of hammer that down a little bit, that then I think there's really a lot of opportunity for that growth and development, whether, you know, the teacher models a new creative thinking process and a student that knows that they think better and work more creatively independently. And they say, okay, I got that new model from the teacher and now I'm going to go over here and I'm going to have some quiet time to sort of sort through that. Or another group says, oh, I really am the kind of learner and creator that I need to hear what others are creating. And then that helps my process. And you know, that could even be differentiated as well in terms of how the creative process looks in a given classroom.
You know, you mentioned that students will often walk in and say, you know, I'm not artistic or I'm not very creative. I've found, you know, similarly in working with pre-service teachers, that the two things that I will hear from them based on their own schooling experience will be, I'm not good at math, right? Math anxiety is really strong, and I'm not artistic. The moment we do a sketch note, even when I say, like, I'm not grading it on the artistry. In fact, I'm not going to grade it. Like, you're just going to do it. It's going to be an activity. There's a lot of fear, and there's a lot of like the self-definition of I'm not creative or I'm not an artist. And so I'm wondering, you know, what are some things that teachers at all the different age levels can do? And I realize you're an elementary teacher, but, you know, what are some things that teachers can do to reduce that risk aversion and to get them over the fear of taking creative risks?
I think you have to start by cultivating a safe space where students feel comfortable with whatever they produce. And so, you know, I'll give you a recent example. I let my fifth grade students, they're, you know, 2 weeks away from being done and moving on to middle school here in Tennessee. And I gave them a ceiling tile. And so I climbed up there, took it out of the ceiling and gave them this blank slate. And, you know, some of the students immediately got started and they created something gorgeous. Another student who had told me the day before, she was so excited about this project that she could not sleep. And then she came in and she painted this gorgeous background. But when she started painting her words, she had chosen a brush that was a little bit too big. And so her spacing got off and then she had to kind of break a word in an awkward place to make it fit on the tile. And you could just see the panic just kind of setting in. And I said, we have a couple of options here, but our best bet might be to just go back to the drawing board and to start over and kind of go back to that blank slate. And so that is ultimately what we did. And so for her, that was just saying, you know, okay, I had this great idea and I had all this energy and all this excitement, but it's not looking the way that I thought it was going to look. And that's okay. We can hang it on the ceiling, you know, as is, and the words, you know, kind of broken in a place you don't want it. And, you know, there's a few spatial issues, or we can create again. And so I think just, you know, knowing each individual student and what that looks like for another student, that would have absolutely broken their heart, you know, 45 minutes into the process to start over. So I think you kind of have to know your individual students and what's going to create and cultivate that safe space for them to try. And then the second time she knew exactly how she wanted to do it differently. And she said, it was my spacing. I got so excited and I wrote that first word too big and then I just couldn't fit everything else in. And so I think that when you create a space where it is safe and it is okay and it is acceptable to make mistakes, and then that develops problem solving, because that was kind of where we were, was, okay, well, we're 45 minutes into this kind of exciting task. And so these are the options that we have. We can start over. We can try to fix it. You know, what are our choices here? So I think really creating a space where students feel safe to try. Brené Brown has a quote that says, the magic is in the mess. And so I think really just feeling safe in that, you know, that creative space, and there's things everywhere and nothing looks quite like you want it to, but that's sometimes where the magic is and where the experience happens and where the learning occurs. And so I think just kind of knowing your individual students and how they feel in that process and how you can support them, you know, and even giving my own examples of times that I've been in similar situations. And, you know, you hate it when you're so close to being finished and you've got a word that's off center. And then, you know, that throws that look. But especially with intellectually gifted learners, perfectionism can be a real struggle, and it can be for so many of us, you know, and sort of that sometimes really lends itself well to those conversations and that social emotional development when it's not going to be perfect, when a word is off center or too large or too small. And, you know, how can we go back in? And is it a time to wipe the slate clean and start again, or are there some other ways that we can problem solve to still create something that we're really proud of?
I love it. And I love that thought even of modeling it yourself as a teacher, because it just seems to model risk-taking through vulnerability and humility, right? And I think there's just a lot of psychological safety created in a classroom when a teacher leans into humility and just owns their mistakes and says, hey, I experimented, and look, that was a failed experiment, and that's okay. You know, mistakes are failed experiments, and that's all right. And getting past that, especially like you said, for gifted students who deal with that sort of gifted perfectionism, it is something that is really hard. Have you ever had to, I'm just curious, when it comes to modeling, have you ever, you know, talked to students where you say, oh man, I messed up, it didn't work well, and it's bothering me that it didn't work well, and I'm like, have you opened them up to moments of perfectionism that you've gone through, and like modeled how the thinking process where you get yourself out of that?
Absolutely. One example that I share with them in terms of creating is I make a lot of anchor charts, which are just those visual, you know, ways that we anchor student learning. And I try to make those really eye-catching and really engaging and really captivating. And so I could totally empathize with the student and her spacing issue, because, you know, I get so excited to create this new anchor chart and I'll be on the very last word and I'll make a spelling error, or I won't have room for the very last letter of the very last word. And I've just meticulously created this. So I have those that I can show my students and say, see, you know, right here, I didn't even have room for that last letter. And so, you know, was I going to start the project over, or were there other ways that I could, you know, creatively problem solve? And something I really focus on with students too is to decide really when and where that is best utilized. And so by that, I mean, you know, when we have students on just an independent practice page, and, you know, I have students that I'll watch and they will, you know, erase a letter three times because it's not perfect, but it's just a quick, you know, rote, you know, practice page, and then they're moving on. And so that's something that I really work with students on as well, in terms of managing their time and also sort of helping them understand their perfectionistic techniques, is when and where is the best place for that? You know, is it on a homework sheet that's just a quick thing that you're going to do and move on? Is that the place to really spend all of that time and energy feeling frustrated if something doesn't look just the way you want? Or a ceiling tile that's going to hang in my classroom long after this fifth grader is gone? And so really kind of justifying and helping them as well with that creative process, because we're constantly creating new things, and some of those are things that are quick, and, you know, they're not going to be a published piece. It's just something, you know, is as simple as homework, or, you know, something that will, you know, hang long after a student is gone. And so that's another way that I really help them sort of evaluate and measure when are the times that we really want to make sure we get it right, because it is something that we're proud of, that we're going to put on display, and then other times where perhaps we can develop and grow in that area and sort of measure that it's a less important time for something to be just right. Because I think we can always look at it with a new lens and say, oh, well, that could have been a little better, I could have changed that. So kind of really deciding where and when is the best place to really apply that. And it's a great strength, versus when is that something that's going to hinder us a little bit and cause us to get behind on other assignments or feel a little bit overwhelmed or constantly behind. So I think that's really important too.
Absolutely. And I'm reminded of just the ceiling tile is a great example. The museum, you know, having students creating their own museum, that whole concept, it's just such a reminder that students will work really hard and they will stretch themselves and they will do so much when there's an authentic audience, right? And what's going on is, like, there's something that's very high stakes, it's high pressure. But that creates a lot of fear and concern. And so then it seems like you can have something that's high stakes, but then you have something that is a chance to make mistakes, rehearsal, whatever it may be, revision. You know, I'm thinking about if students are doing a production, there's a rehearsal time ahead of time. If students are doing a museum, there's a revision time built in. I love that notion of the dance between the low stakes and the high stakes, right? You can make as many mistakes as possible, but but it's still going to be sent to a real audience, and that is high stakes, and we're going to get over some of that fear, and it's going to be a safe space for sure, but there's going to be discomfort because you're going to face your fears a little bit and share it with, you know, somebody different, some kind of audience. And it just seems like I love that notion of having those two kind of working together. So final question is, if a teacher is saying, okay, I love some of these ideas, there's some practical things that I can do, there's some ways to integrate creativity, but again, it feels a little overwhelming, I'm not sure where to go first, what would you say would be a great first step? Check out this or try this, an initial thing where you would say, next week I could blank.
There's a book that I use that's a great resource. It's called The Creativity Calendar. And so that has been a really helpful resource for me because that really hits on each of those four, the fluency, flexibility, originality, and elaboration. And mm-hmm. So that makes it really easy. I think sometimes for us to conceptualize and plan, that can be a bit difficult or challenging. And just like you mentioned earlier, that aspect of that precious time and where and how are we going to spend and invest that. But that book, The Creativity Calendar, is filled with ways to practice each of those four methods for every month of the year. And so it even includes like a little calendar that you could use just to make sure that you're hitting on those. But for me, I just make a goal that once a week, I try to hit on each of the four. And so in the month of May, you know, once each week, I will touch on fluency, flexibility, originality, and elaboration. So that's a great specific resource just because it already has so many ideas generated for teachers. And so that was something that was shared with me a couple of years ago to professional development. And then I immediately thought, oh, I got to have that in my collection. And so I immediately ordered that. And I think I found it on eBay. So it was super discounted and it was an older model or an older copy, but it's worked out beautifully for my students.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for sharing. And for people who are new, who haven't met you before, what are some ways that they could reach out to you?
The best way would probably just be through my personal email. So that's S as in Stephanie Higgs, my last name. So that's SHIGGS01@gmail.com. I do have a Twitter account, but it's not a high tech, you know, professional Twitter by any means. So that's @StephanieHiggs, but I definitely think my personal email would be the easiest way to contact me. And I really do just love learning and I love sharing. So if anybody was interested in future conversations or how this might be implemented, or even, you know, I love the scamper model, but I'm not really quite sure where that could fit in. I would love to, you know, to look through standards and help find a place for something like that. So I'd love to be in touch and, you know, summer's 2 weeks away. That would give me something fun this summer to be thinking about and how I could support other teachers in their quest for creativity.
All right. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this interview. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.